It's got a death curse.
Don't bother me, be like me. And then who will lock you up in the sewer?
Just like having a wart removed.
What's the boogeyman?
As a matter of fact, it was.
The third commercial, it's still on, please. Watch. Take off the third channel, it's still running. Stop it, please, for God's sake, please stop it. There's no more time. You've got to, please, stop it now. Turn it off, stop it.
Okay, it's Cash Wampum here for Horror 101. It's our second podcast. I'm here with the world famous Brian Stewart.
Yo.
And special guest, it's the cult sensation, Nick McPherson.
Pleasure to be here.
Yes, it's nice to have you two gentlemen here. Now, I had you here tonight to watch Halloween 3, which we just watched. Now, we've all seen it before, but I wanted this to be kind of like the hidden gem of this podcast. What are your thoughts, Nick, about Halloween 3? What do you think about this one?
Well, like I was saying earlier, it's a quintessential 80s horror film. You know, it's got all the elements, things that are so period-based, you know, problems that we would never have now. But even, you know, it's completely, you know, disassociated from the rest of the Halloween series. It's always been a huge favorite of mine.
That's what happened to it. John Carpenter wanted to make a Halloween-themed movie every year, and they started with Halloween 3. So what had happened was they made this movie, and everybody thought it was going to be another sequel with Michael Myers. But they get in there, and it's about this druid mask maker that wants to kill everybody with his masks. And everybody was so... they were upset because they thought they were led astray. But take that element away. Like you said earlier, if it was just called Season of the Witch and not Halloween 3, I think it would have done much better, because it is a very good movie. It doesn't have a happy ending. It's got some good gore in it. I love Tom Atkins. You guys are making fun of the mustache. Tom Atkins is the man. I'll say it one more time. The stash is the man. You haven't seen him in Night of the Creeps yet?
Not yet.
Brian Stewart?
Next time.
Again, you disappoint me with the movies that you have not seen. You've seen everything except for the fucking great horror movies.
You and I came from different backgrounds. You watched horror, you saw the first grotesque thing on film, and you thought, my God, and you went for it. There are two types of reaction. There are the people who say, I want more. And then there are the people who, like me, who ran screaming and avoided horror for years. And so most of my time I've spent... well, the most frightening stuff I ever got went towards was thrillers. So I probably liked the fact that I was frightened, but I didn't like the gore. So I dove into thrillers and dramas and that sort of thing. So yeah, I haven't seen very much in the way of horror. I'm kind of getting to it now in my adult years. So, what I like about it, though, as a Halloween movie, not as a part of the Halloween franchise, but as a movie for the Halloween season, is that it does more than just give you some monster that's killing people and it's us versus it. There really is a mystery to it, which I appreciate.
Oh, it's like if there's like a James Bond level supervillain with no James Bond to stop him, instead we get Dr. Mustache.
Right.
Hey, Tom Atkins is the man. I don't care what you say about the fucking mustache. Look, Halloween masks created by Don Post. You could actually buy these masks.
Yeah?
Yeah, those three masks.
The same unless
made
you're playing
a whole
the
bunch
theme
of
song while you're walking around. Be great.
The thing is I call it a hidden gem because it's good horror. As far as B-horror goes, early 80s, this was a fantastic movie. It had a kind of a smart story, as long as you just gobble up what they're telling you. This druid comes by, he's fucking rich. They bring over this piece of rock from Stonehenge, and it just mystically has this power. They know the equation to bring out this awesome power in it, and they're going to destroy all the families on Halloween night. To bring Halloween back to the... its roots of really weird, mystic, macabre kind of holiday.
You must fear and respect the festival of Samhain.
That's right. He even goes in to say, you know, you don't really know much about Halloween. Let me tell you exactly what Halloween's supposed to be.
You don't fuck with druids. That's just it.
Especially not around Halloween. But Tom Atkins and Dan O'Herlihy?
Yep, Dan O'Herlihy. O'Herlihy.
Every time I see him, though, I think RoboCop. He's the old man RoboCop.
Well, yeah, he didn't even realize that he was Grig in the last Starfighter. It's that voice.
Yeah, and you had mentioned that, too. I had completely forgotten, and then I'm listening to the voice going, yeah. Well, he was behind some heavy fucking makeup.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, that voice, that was definitely him.
Keep waiting for him to say it's time for Death Blossom.
Don't touch that button!
I think what may have hurt it, too, is that it doesn't feel like a movie you would see in movie theaters. It feels like the kind of movie you'd see, like, on a, you know, Saturday afternoon on Channel 20.
Yeah.
It feels like a low-budget made-for-TV kind of movie.
This was, like, made for something like that.
That's precisely where I watched it. Probably why I love it so much is because I wasn't a theater goer back in 82. You know, if I was watching anything back then, it was E.T. with the parents or something like that. Yeah, but still, I mean, not very graphic, but there's some interesting death sequences. The whole thing where the family's in the test room and the kid gets whacked and the things come out of its head and actually kill, well, I don't know, the wife has a heart attack, but the rattlesnake takes care of the dad.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was just like, that is awesome horror. Every time I watch that scene, it's just like, and the music getting faster and faster and faster as it's concluding. It doesn't have a happy ending. I say no.
No, they didn't stop
it. I say that fucking third channel kept airing it because it was already at the 0 hour. That fucking pumpkin was flashing, man. It was flashing.
Well, they wanted to lead you right up to the moment of pure dread and then just leave it hanging.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't want to leave it one way or the other.
I appreciated that as well. Like even now, that's 30 years ago. We're still asking the question, did he get it in time or did everybody die?
Well, a lot of my favorite, like, horror, just slash, you know, like, thriller suspense movies in general are ones that end off like that. You know, no, you know, guarantee the good guy wins and walks off into the sunset. Like, you don't know. Did he do it? Yeah. Did he not?
It's like right out of almost the 1970s filmmaking where endings were allowed to be unresolved, where it was actually more frightening to not have everything all nice and neatly solved in a little puzzle. But you had movies like Spielberg's Duel, where you never find out why the truck driver was such a psychotic lunatic or why he picked on Dennis Weaver, of all people.
Yeah.
You know, or it's like the ending to Hitchcock's Birds. You don't know why the birds went crazy. It's never resolved. They're still there.
Well, even, like, you know, it was a Day of the Triffids, if you want to get in, like, the weird stuff.
Right.
Like that. You know, like, shit just happens. There's no explanation. I think, what's his name, Shyamalan, tried to do something like that with The Happening, but failed miserably. Like, I can get what he was kind of going for, but
it's funny that he bothered to give us an explanation at all, but no explanation would have been far more interesting.
Yeah, like, it just happened. It was done. That's it.
Yeah.
So, do you like it or not?
Oh, yeah, I love that movie.
I think it's an underrated movie. I think it's one definitely that deserves underrated. Another look for people who may have given just a passing glance that one time and dismissed it as a non-Myers film.
Yeah.
I think we should go back and look at it again.
At the same time, it's a victim of bad promotion, bad titling, and to an extent, you know, with age, it's a victim of some of its own shortcomings.
The other problem, too, is that it drags a lot. Like,
yes.
It really does pad for time. It has a great idea, but it would probably have played better as, like, a single episode of, Tales from the Crypt or something.
Yeah.
You know, you could have gotten away in a half-hour format. So, it feels like it was probably written for television and then was expanded on.
Had too much gore for television in 1982, that's for damn sure.
Yeah.
1982, they still weren't saying hell or damn on television, for crying out loud.
Yeah, that was the thing that kind of confused me. It's like, okay, you're going to go for the gore, you're going to go for the hard R, but at the same time, you know, the homeless guy is pretty much the only one that swears in the whole damn movie. Like, even the coroner, it's like, oh, you know, somebody made a boo-boo.
Yeah.
Actually, the guy that wrote this story, his name was like Dan or Don Neal or Neely. I forget exactly how you say the name. He wrote the story and they bought it off him. They're like, we want to make this movie, this Halloween movie out of it. And he's like, sure. Then they made the movie and I think they added some of the gore scenes into the movie. And after that, he wanted his name taken completely off of it. So I think this movie was planned by the original writer to be a little bit more of a wholesome, tragic story. And they threw in gore for gore's sake because it was a horror movie in the early 80s. He's like, you know what, if that's what you want to do with the story, just take my name right off the credits. So, the score for this movie, done by Carpenter and his friends there, annoying, but effective. I always thought it was effective, like the drive to Santa Mira, the first chase there where the guy's running away from the assassins in the cars there, all that music, when it gets twitchy, like you said at one part, it sounded like a smoke alarm. I'm thinking, he's absolutely correct. It sounds like a goddamn smoke alarm. But other than that, it was pretty solid. Very simple, but just it adds that correct atmosphere with the movie. It works.
Yeah, you want it to be sparse and empty. You want there to be gaps in the music so that you feel like you're unprotected, that you're not... that you're out in the open. That's what it should feel like. Like you're in the middle of a large open field with nowhere to hide. And if you can put those gaps in the music, you really do feel quite alone.
Your subconscious sense of, like, what the hell is that, suddenly kicks in.
Yeah.
What you really need to see is a demonstration, and there's one coming right up.
Nick, a big horror fan, yes or no?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like I said, if it wasn't for my grandfather's senility and picking the wrong movies off the rack when you go to the video store, I never would have been exposed to it when I was a kid. I send him to get Goonies, and he brings back Ghoulies.
Ghoulies is a fun movie. It's one of those movies, it's all set in one location, and I really like that, you know. It has black magic in it, just like this one. It's got zombies, it's got little monsters called Ghoulies. The first one was actually... a horror movie. It just got stupid after that. It got silly. By the time Ghoulies 4, Ghoulies Go to Fucking College, or whatever the hell it was. I think that was 3, actually. It was just stupid. I stopped watching him at that point.
So I will say, the exception to the rule was, I used to love Vincent Price movies, watching horror films. But it's not like the typical, like, it's not like, you know, the more grotesque, you know, films coming out of Italy. It's not like the zombie movies, or Night of the Living Dead, or like Sam Raimi coming later. The Vincent Price, Christopher Lee, you know, the old Roddy McDowall horror films... they were all not about the grotesque. It was more about atmosphere.
Right.
And those movies I appreciated more.
Vincent Price, anything American international pictures with him, all his Poe work, like
Casket of Amontillado,
Temple of Legea,
Hidden the Pendulum.
Yeah.
You guys took them all. Fuck.
Not The Raven, based off the poem.
The Raven with a very young
Great
Jack
Nicholson. Duel between him and. And Boris Karloff.
I remember watching that when I was a kid going, wow. And even, like, the star power of that scene. You watch that scene right now and the effects are so cheesy. It just... the only thing that is stopping you from laughing it off the screen is the fact that on one end of the room, you got Boris Karloff. And on the other end of the room, you've got Vincent fucking Price. And it's just like, oh!
You look at the cast of that movie.
It's like Freddy vs. Jason back then. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You got Peter Lorre in there, Jack Nicholson in there. I mean, you'll never see that kind of cast again. It's... just unbelievable.
Well, not unless you're UA Ball and have a disturbingly large amount of money to throw at Ben Kingsley.
He's got to have pictures of Ben Kingsley doing something I don't want to know about.
Welcome to Fright Night. For real.
The Fright Night remake, like I said, like it started out kind of the same, and then it got completely off track. It was like a brand new movie, and then it's like the writers were like, well, fuck, we better... start getting back to the things that Fright Night did, and they started putting elements from the original movie.
Really shoehorned in a lot of stuff, but I mean, like you and I were talking about earlier, for the first two thirds of the original Fright Night, Charlie's still trying to convince people that there's a vampire living next door.
Yeah, because he keeps botching up his evidence.
Yeah,
he brings the cops there, and he completely fucks up the story, and nobody believes him. His mom don't believe him. His girlfriend doesn't believe him. His friend doesn't believe him. His friend that's Uber into fucking vampires. Yeah. Doesn't even believe him.
That's right. Evil Ed laughed at him.
He's like, whatever. He's don't call me evil anymore.
But and the new one, it just seemed really kind of lazy. They didn't want to bother with all the trials and tribulations that Charlie went through in the original. It was all pretty well, you know, answered for him. I mean, in the original, I mean, Jerry Danvers from the original, the Chris Sarandon character, was a lot smarter about it. I mean, he really did try to cover his tracks.
Well, he was older, too. He was 1,000 years old. This guy was only apparently 400 years old.
Well, even then, it doesn't matter. If he behaved like that for 400 years, how in the hell is he still alive?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
You know, the whole idea, like, part of the whole thing with vampires is, like, the really old ones is they're supposed to have this down to a T, and the whole premise of most of those movies is, you know, this is the one kid who's smart enough and picks up on it enough to actually clue in on it.
Right.
But in this one, he's fucking broadcasting it.
He had a much better cover story, too, and he also had, like, the servant that protected him during the daytime.
The familiar. The
familiar, yeah.
And in the original, he had a better story. He basically just fixed up old houses. He had a live-in carpenter. They would fix up old houses, flip them, and move on, which helped set up the transient lifestyle, because he would move from town to town, and that made sense. But in this one, he was just like some construction worker that worked at night on the Vegas Strip. And I'm pretty sure they do construction in the daytime in Vegas, too, so that was all about it. But,
Yeah, sometimes it just seems like they just don't put as much thought as they should into...
The club scene was laughable. I mean, they must have forgotten all about it until near the end of the new one. And they're like, oh yeah, there's
a club scene.
It was like 45 seconds long, and they basically run from Peter Vincent's apartment to the club. It was like...
Same building. In Vegas. Well, you know what? It's Vegas, man. They could have a building.
They screwed up, too, because in the original, when Charlie tells the bodyguards, hey, this guy's attacking that woman, the bodyguards do react. But Chris Sarandon dispatches these huge built bodyguards quickly and easily, and it makes this thin kind of, you know, almost, you know, bony-looking Chris Sarandon, definitely small guy.
Yeah.
Very frightening. All of a sudden, his power did seem supernatural. It was almost like, you know,
the glowing red eyes and the fangs didn't clue in on that scene.
Well, no, but I mean, the ordinary, he looks typical, right? But the second he did, you know, dispatches this huge 300-pound muscled bodyguard quickly and easily, it really sells it. Like I say, it's kind of like in T2, how instead of going with a bigger guy than Arnold Schwarzenegger, they go with, you know, Robert Patrick, who's much smaller, and it works.
Yeah, because his technology is devastating. Who cares how big he is?
Well, that's the whole idea. Is like you're supposed to, like, especially with villains in these movies, the whole idea is that, you know, they're supposed to be unassuming until, you know, like, you're not supposed to know what they're made of right off the bat.
Well, I mean, right off the bat in this, I mean, freaking Colin Farrell looks like a vampire out of Twilight. You know, he looks like the new modern
he's pale. Sparkle. Vampire. Yeah, like right out of the gate, he's pale. You know what I mean?
Yeah. One of the things I liked about Sarandon is that the first time you see him, he's wearing that white trench coat. You know, he's all dressed in white, except he has that red scarf, you know. Like it's, but he doesn't dress like a typical villain. He looks like a nice guy.
Yeah.
The dialogue in the original scene, when you find out that Charlie's mother had absentmindedly just invited him in, and he's sitting in the armchair, and you get that beautiful scene with Chris Sarandon saying, well, you know, I'll just stop by whenever I want now. Of course, with your mother's kind permission.
Yeah, even to the end, he's debutante about it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
With your mother's kind permission, of course. Well, you know,
he's just smiling the whole time.
I just threatened your son, but I'm going to make it look like it was nothing and I'm a real gentleman.
Yeah. All right, easily he opens up the window after his when he's attacking him in the bedroom. He's got it nailed shut and he just single fingers it. But he, the whole time, is just very kind of smooth and smiling and polite about it, and just, he's, you know, politely vicious. And it just works. I missed that chemistry.
Now, we wouldn't want to wake your mother, would we, Charlie? Then I'd have to kill her, too.
Right up!
Just everything that I liked about the original was gone in the new one. They took pretty well taken everything out of it that I liked.
Before, when they remade a movie, it was an homage. Like when Carpenter did The Thing, he remade The Thing because he watched The Thing in the 50s when he was a kid. It scared the shit out of him, and since then he was passionate about movies. He made horror movies, so what's the best thing for him to do? The fucking one movie that scared the shit out of him. These people now, they're just buying up rights to movies and throwing money at it and saying, make a movie and make sure that 14-year-olds can pay for the tickets. And it's just not working.
No.
It's not working. Fright Night has no gore in it. No boobies. There's really no reason for it to be a PG-13. That could have been a PG movie. I think there wasn't even a lot of excessive swearing. No drug use. No smoking. Just sex talk. That's it. Just a little bit of innuendo. That's it. That's all that movie had.
Well, that, and don't forget over there, they're getting a little fidgety even when it comes to violence now. Like, there are movies that we used to see when we were kids that were PG that were a hell of a lot more hardcore than a lot of these remakes.
The original Fright Night had, especially the familiar death scene, like, that scene right there had enough gruesome gore in it to turn off a lot of fucking people, but I think it was... The movie was so smart, and it was fun at the same time. It wasn't dark. It wasn't just like, here, take some gore and fucking take it. It was a fun movie with some comedy. It was for everyone. But it had that kind of gore, but it kind of slid through, almost like
it tapped into the same kind of frequency as Goonies. You know, it was kind of a fun violence. There was always the threat of danger or violence, but at the same time, it was enjoyable.
Well, you're watching somebody melt, like horribly melt, and the noises he makes as he's melting is just horrible. Then he turns to fucking sand, and then he's a dripping skeleton.
All the little bits of bone falling too.
The skull flying across and smacking off the dormer or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, it was...
The one thing that really I noticed probably most off that it was missing in the in the new film was the whole idea of faith. Faith in the original movie was Roddy McDowall really losing faith in the horror genre.
Yeah.
Like, he pretty well saw himself as a fraud. He had just lost his job because nobody wanted to see the kind of movies that he was in. He'd given his entire life to the franchise of horror films, and now he felt like he was being thrown away. And nothing, it didn't mean anything to him. He had lost his faith, really, in horror.
Yeah.
In horror films.
And what do we get in this one? We get David Tennant channeling Russell Brand as a Vegas stage magician.
Like, I mean, the redemption of Peter Vincent in the original, I thought, had a lot more to say about the genre. And it was a lot more insightful.
Everybody loves an underdog.
I never thought of that. The whole faith, like, you have to have faith for that to work, Mr. Vincent kind of deal. Now all of a sudden he gets his faith and it starts to work.
Yeah.
It starts repelling the vampire.
I mean,
that's kind of profound what you said, that it's not faith in Christ, whereas that's basically what it is. If you're holding a cross, you got to have faith in Christ, right?
But he's holding his movie props.
That's right. But you have to have faith in, kind of like yourself as a horror star.
Exactly.
To beat me.
I think that's what it really was.
That's very interesting take on that.
Or even just, you know, metaphorically saying, you know, have faith in yourself.
Even,
you know,
it's pretty washed up.
Yeah.
They kind of play on that. There's a scene in the remake where Buddy, he's got this huge cross. I forget where he's got it, but Charlie's got this huge cross. And Farrell's doing the whole quirky thing again. He's like, that's an awfully big cross you got there, Charlie. You know, like, it is kind of affecting him.
Mm.
But he's like, do you have faith for it? Then he just grabs it and it just immolates.
Yeah.
So it, you know, I'm like, oh, good. So they're putting the whole you gotta have faith for that to work kind of thing into it. And then as before, I even know it, he's just grabbing it out of his hands and like,
it was really gone. Another element of the original that they just shoehorned in there because it was in the original. They don't really know why it was there. They didn't have the insight into the original that they could do anything with it. They just put it in there because they were just trying to copy.
It wasn't even imitation. It was almost a mockery.
Yeah.
Unintentionally so.
They saw it as one ingredient in a list of ingredients to try and do the remake. They have no idea why they were there or how they were supposed to work together. They thought, well, there was fate, there was a club scene, you know, there was some vampire hunter. Fine, we'll just...
It was a grocery list.
It was, yeah.
I miss Stephen Jeffries as Evil Ed, but this Evil Ed was entertaining.
I was worried because it's like McLovin.
Yeah,
really?
McLovin.
It was a completely different Evil Ed, like the same, only different. But the writing for his dialogue made him very interesting.
But what's interesting, what I don't really like though, is that they kind of introduced the idea of betrayal of his original friends, and I thought maybe, you know, the faith that was referred to in the first movie might have been his faith in his old life, making the silly kind of movies with his friends, trying to be his, you know, his true to himself again. Because he dismisses this his old friend, he writes him off, he treats him like shit. I mean, he treats him like absolute dirt. And yet it's never resolved. He never apologizes for it. Evil Ed just goes out being an outcast and then he gets killed. I mean, Charlie never has to pay for what he did to his friend. He never has to...
But he tells him it's all right at the end, right before he immolates. He's
of course,
looking at
him. Because
he's
Charlie
like,
doesn't have to work very hard in this movie. It's not like Charlie Brewster of the original where the poor guy suffered. He looked like an outcast. He looked like he was losing his mind. He was really struggling to get people to listen to him. In the new movie, Charlie doesn't have to work very hard. It's all pretty well done.
No, his within 5 minutes, his ex-best friend's telling him what's up. Yeah, this is what's up.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't go as far as to tell him the hard evidence that Buddy finds after, but he's like, this is what's up. Don't you get it? And the fact that, like, their schoolmates are missing, and Buddy's like, you know, yeah, they've been missing 2 days. I don't get, you know, people were gone for 2-3 days in school. I didn't get upset about it, especially if I weren't very close to them. Okay, people have business. They get sick, whatever.
Yeah.
And he's like, don't you even care? What kind of person are you? You don't even care that people are missing? They've been gone 48 hours. Fuck the cops.
The cops are barely getting
that.
Involved now, yeah.
You saw something in there, didn't you? You saw something that convinced you he was a vampire.
Of course not.
Please, Mr. Vincent, you have to tell me. Our lives depend on that.
All right. He didn't cast a reflection in my mirror.
Satisfied now? Mr. Vincent, you have to call the police. Mr. Vincent, shit!
And that is going to be the end of the second Horror 101 podcast. I want to thank again my good friends, the world-famous Brian Stewart and the cult sensation Nick McPherson, for coming over and watching a pair of really good horror movies with me, Halloween 3, The Season of the Witch, and the original Fright Night, both really good movies. We had fun watching them, dissecting them, discussing what we liked and what we didn't like about them. The remake of Fright Night, as you know, we didn't really appreciate, and we talked about why.
And I just got to say that this is really fun for me, more fun than I thought it would be, to go back and revisit these movies and share with you the points that we think make them good movies. I know a lot of people aren't listening to me at this point because we're brand new. And if there's just one person that listens to this podcast and hears of a movie that they might not have ever heard of, or had heard of, but they just put it on the back burner, never seen it, and they go to watch the movie because we said to do it. And if you love that movie, then our job is done. That is the point, because I guarantee you that there is a horror movie out there that's going to scare the shit out of you. And we're going to help you find it at Horror 101, educating your fears.